Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Indie director Cary Fukunaga was a California boy, Japanese father, Swedish mother, made his name with a powerful film about Central Americans, migrants, riding the hard rails north across Mexico. Now he's turned to Charlotte Bronte, the windswept moors of Yorkshire, and the great 19th century tale, Jane Eyre. This hour on Point, director Cary Fukunaga and Jane Eyre. You can join the conversation. What keeps Jane Eyre, the poor, the obscure, the plain, as she calls herself, coming back to the big screen? Did you see Cary Fukunaga's first feature film, Sin Nombre? Can you picture his eye taken to Jane Eyre? Of course, Jane Eyre, the orphan raised by a cruel aunt sent off to a terrible boarding school. Here's just a taste of what this imagined 19th century girl's life was like. Off at boarding school, here's the headmaster.
Do you know, Jane Eyre, where the wicked go after death?
They go to hell.
And what is hell?
Where are you, Ran?
If you don't sit still, you will be tied down.
A pit full of fire.
Should you like to fall into this pit and be burned there forever?
People think you are good, but you are hard-hearted.
Get out.
Children, I exhort you to withhold the hand of friendship to Jane Eyre.
From the trailer there of Cary Fukunaga's Jane Eyre, it's a tough, tough beginning, and it stays tough. She's always up against the limitations of her time, of the culture she lives in, of her gender, of her very self. And here's a little bit where Jane Eyre, played by Mia Wasikowska, learns that Rochester, the great Rochester, the aristocrat in whose home she has served as a governess, he's played by Michael Fassbender, is to be married to another. She's fallen in love with him, so she tells him she can no longer be a governess in his household. He tries to convince her to stay in Cary Fukunaga's new Jane Eyre.
I have lived a full life here. I have not been trampled on. I have not been petrified. I have not been excluded from every glimpse of what is bright. I have known you, Mr. Rochester. And it strikes me with anguish to be torn from you.
Then why must you leave?
Because of your wife.
I have no wife.
But you are to be married.
Jane, you must stay.
I become nothing to you. Am I a machine without feelings? Do you think that because I am poor, obscure, plain and little, that I am soulless and heartless? I have as much soul as you and full as much heart. And if God had blessed me with beauty and wealth, I could make it as hard for you to leave me as it is for I to leave you. I'm not speaking to you through mortal flesh. It is my spirit that addresses your spirit, as if we'd passed through the grave and stood at God's feet equal. As we are.
As we are.
'Tis my spirit that addresses your spirit. There's the ideal, but there's a lot of surround. Jane Eyre, Cary Fukunaga is the director. It opens this weekend in Los Angeles and New York, next in Washington, Atlanta, Boston, and then beyond right across the country. You can join us at 800-423-8255. What do you hope for in a new Hollywood telling of Jane Eyre? Cary Fukunaga joins me now from New York. He wrote and directed the celebrated 2009 film Sin Nombre about the dangerous train-top journey to the U.S. of Central American migrants. His new film, Jane Eyre, stars Mia Wasikowska, who played the young daughter in last year's The Kids Are All Right as Jane, and Michael Fassbender as her gothic love interest, Rochester. The film opens today, as I say, in New York and Los Angeles. Cary Fukunaga, welcome to On Point. Thanks very much for being here.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for having me.
18, maybe 19 times now in a century this has been made. First reviews are coming in, and they are very, very laudatory. What took you to Jane Eyre from Chiapas in Mexico and train tops and gangs there, Cary?
Well, I think after spending about 5 years researching and making that film, like you said, on top of freight trains and all over Central America and a lot of time in prisons, I think the idea of trading in the gangs and trains for corsets and horses in northern England sounded pretty interesting.
How does something like this happen? I mean, here you are, you're 33 now. I don't know how long ago it was that this was proposed. Sin Nombre was your first feature film, wonderfully received, prizes and all the rest. Nevertheless, you're not that many years out of NYU Film School. How does it happen? How does a deal like to do Jane Eyre come to a young director?
I just got lucky in a way, in the same way that the story for Sin Nombre came to me while doing research for a short film I did at NYU. And I studied history undergrad at UC Santa Cruz. And so I'm pretty familiar with the 19th century. It was part of my focus. And I knew about Jane Eyre as a kid because of the Bob Stevenson film. It was one of my favorites.
This is back with Fontaine and Orson Welles.
Exactly. And it was one of my mom's favorite films. And so you know, I watched it at home quite often. And when I was in the UK promoting Sin Nombre, I found out that the BBC had a Jane Eyre, a feature version, on their slate, and I wanted to read it and find out what they were going to do with that. And that was Moira Buffini's, I think, first draft of what would become this version of Jane Eyre. Yeah. And I really liked what she did. So I had a meeting with the producers while I was out there, and we kind of were on the same page about what we wanted to do with the film and sort of updating, I think, the Bob Stevenson version versus other sort of more standard romantic portrayals of the story.
You said Jane Austen is like Gossip Girl, and Charlotte and Emily Bronte were like goth twins. Take us there.
Well, I just think that I think partially based on their life experience, I'd been out to the parsonage where they grew up, and they basically grew up in this tiny house surrounded by a cemetery, and death was all around them in isolation. I think that's definitely an element in their stories. I mean, their imaginations knew new limits, but their lives definitely had, you know, limited horizons.
Charlotte and Emily Bronte, sisters who grew up sent off by their parson father to be governesses themselves, not easy lives. And then within the space of 1 year, 1847, Bronte sisters coming out, I think, with three novels, Wuthering Heights and Jane Eyre, and more, that turned them into big stars. Charlotte Bronte did not live long. Take us back to how she presents, and the story that drew you in here, signing up for this, Carrie. Take us back to how she presents the lot of this young woman, Jane Eyre, and the time and circumstances she was facing.
Well, I think it's hard to separate Jane Eyre from Charlotte Bronte in terms of perspective on the world and on women's role in society. And in many ways, Jane, the observer, the book is written from her first-person perspective, is all about the frustrations of being a woman, in this case in the late 1830s, early 1840s, as the novel sort of set back about 10 years from when it was published. And you get the sense that Jane and obviously Charlotte are extremely intelligent people, understand people's personalities and emotions well, and are it's the oppression or repression they feel from their place in society and what they're able to do as women, whereas what men can do sort of gallivanting around the world. And at this point, you know, this is English empire spread around the globe. You know, to seek adventure, to have and sort of blaze their own trails was not really possible for them. So as governesses, especially in, you know, this isolation, being in these homes, teaching these young children, that just sort of like, it felt like being in an aquarium or in a cage. And I think they really wanted it to, and deserved to have much of a bigger sort of place in the world.
An aquarium or a cage, or maybe dangling above that pit of hellfire that the headmaster shouts about to Jane in the terrible boarding school there. I mean, you get this terrific tension running through your film, The New Jane Eyre, of this constant feeling of this bright, determined young woman who somehow, despite all the hardships of this sort of worse than Cinderella childhood, she's got such a strong will, but she's hanging kind of over peril at every moment. She under class restrictions, gender restrictions. If she steps out of line, if she acts on her heart's impulses, it always feels as though she could absolutely fall to her doom here.
Yeah, I think that's what makes her an extraordinary character, especially in literature, and why it's still a story that's retold. Given all of the things that happened to her life, the fact that she remains so strong, even at the age of 18, is extraordinary. It shows a strength of character that is rare. And I think Rochester even says that in terms of her uniqueness of opinion as well, that, you know, when she counters his sort of stinging sort of observations of her, she says it with a sort of a singular voice that's not something that's repeating what all her peers would say. It's her own version of what life should be like. And she has this sort of will that's, I don't know, it's steel. And I think what makes it interesting also in terms of a story is that even today and amongst many people in society, we would be so willing to sacrifice our self-dignity in order to hold on to a love, even if it's an incomplete love or a love that is immoral. And she, like most of us, are in search of love but isn't willing to sacrifice herself in order to maintain it.
Here's a moment from Cary Fukunaga's new film, Jane Eyre, where Jane, played by Mia Wasikowska, tells Rochester, the kind of the nobleman in whose home he gallivants everywhere, but she's working as a governess in his home, played by Michael Fassbender, that she will find a new station. She will leave, for she can no longer be his governess if he's going to be married to another.
I am a free human being with an independent will which I now exert to leave you.
Then let your will decide your destiny. I offer you my hand, my heart. Jane, I ask you to pass through life at my side. You are my equal and my likeness. Will you marry me?
Are you mocking me?
Do you doubt me?
Entirely.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back with more Jane Eyre. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour with the new film version of Charlotte Bronte's Jane Eyre with its young director, Cary Fukunaga, the rising new Hollywood talent. You can join the conversation this hour. Are you ready for another round with Jane Eyre, Rochester, the crazy wife in the attic, Thornfield Hall? What keeps Jane Eyre coming back? What is it about this heroine, her story, that still grips? And I guess, were you surprised to see Cary Fukunaga doing this with his one wonderful film on Central American migrants? Did you see Sin Nombre? Were you thinking Jane Eyre while you watched it? Cary Fukunaga joins me now from New York. Cary, we've got a lot of feedback here online. Janine says the message of strong character, redemption, and forgiveness never gets old at a bit of Cinderella, and wow, loves Jane Eyre. Here's Blythe. She says, I like Jane Eyre because it's a love story about two people who are pretty boring and plain, Jane, and rather grumpy, Mr. Rochester, but who still manage to have a beautiful love story that gives hope to all of us that love is not just for the beautiful people. She says she would add Beauty and the Beast to the Cinderella string there. She says she's, and Jane is so strong, a fantastic role model, even or especially today. She will not compromise herself. How many of us are that strong? How did you go about casting this? You've got Mia here. She was, of course, in the Kids Are All Right last year, a young Australian actress. I'm not sure quite how old when you filmed her. How did you pair the Jane figure up with this actress?
I think in my initial meeting with Alison Noe and Moira Buffini, we talked about cast and about me wanting to cast age appropriate. And I think what's fascinating about Jane is that she's only 18 years old when she shows up at Thornfield Hall.
Yeah.
And if you imagine today, you know, youth is extended well into the 20s, but an 18-year-old, given that task, you know, the responsibility of raising basically an 8-year-old,
right,
educating her and being all on your own, it's incredibly overwhelming. You know, Rochester is a figure that's much more sort of, when you're sitting there trying to figure out cast, you can play around with a lot of different names pretty quickly. But for me, the first name and the only person I could really see doing this was Michael Fassbender. I'd seen him in Hunger, playing Bobby Sands, which was in Steve McQueen's mm-hmm. film about the hunger strike in Ireland.
Yeah, intense.
Intense, and I thought his performance in there was mind-blowing. And after seeing that film, I knew I wanted to work with him on something. And so when I read the script, he was the first person that sort of popped up in my mind as an image to play Rochester. Even though he doesn't physically look like what Charlotte Bronte described, I feel like his spirit and his intensity definitely matched it. And then the larger task became, how to find an 18-year-old actress that could play Jane. And so I asked a bunch of friends who had been casting characters around that same age and mm-hmm. who they thought were some of the young up-and-coming actresses. And Mia pretty much came up on everyone's list. And I hadn't seen her in anything up to that point. Alice hadn't come out yet, neither had
Alice in Wonderland.
Yes.
She plays plays Alice, of course.
Yes, exactly. So the only material I could really find on her would be, or at least the best material on her, was an HBO show called In Treatment.
Yeah. She made a big impression there.
Yes, she did. And I watched two episodes of that. And basically, it's 30 minutes of Mia in each episode. And she just, again, I was astounded by how raw and fiery her performance was. And I think she was 17 when she shot that show. At this point, I think she was 19 and she was shooting Gus Van Sant's new film in Portland. So I flew out to meet her and have a conversation with her. And it had turned out that she had been reading Jane Eyre just previous to that. A few months before that, after having finished filming Alice in Wonderland, she came back to Australia and was sort of educating herself and reading classics. And Jane Eyre was one of them. And she'd actually asked her agent if there was a project out there, and her agent wasn't aware of the BBC one. So when we reached out to her, it was sort of kismet.
But you're making a big bet here that she can carry off that incredible determination, the orphan who's starved and whipped and humiliated and somehow carries it in spite of that. Did you find, Cary Fukunaga, that you had to juice up the will and even feminism in Jane Eyre in a 2010-11 telling, or was it all there in the text that Charlotte Bronte gave you from 1847?
I think it's definitely in the text. I read the book again. Well, I read it for the first time, then I reread it. I read it for the first time when I read the script, and then I reread it as we were preparing the film. Because there's, so much information you can mine when you're adapting it. But I think that it's all there, all the frustration, all the passion and the restraint and the sort of like the pressure that creates, inside that corset and all those emotions. It's there. And even the dark gothic elements of it are all there. It's a terrifying book, I think, if you're by yourself in some dark house reading it. And I didn't really have to do anything, and I wasn't interested in sexing it up by any means. Mm-hmm. I wanted to do what, at least in my mind, what I thought Charlotte was trying to do.
It has such a contemporary tension to it, just really fantastic, and great reviews coming in. Congratulations to you on that.
Thank you.
Let's go to Susan in Cambridge, Massachusetts, calling in. Susan, you're on the air with Cary Fukunaga.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I just first have to say right off the bat, this is my all-time favorite novel, going back to adolescence, Wuthering Heights being number two, not surprisingly.
The two sisters deliver for you.
Yes, yes. I could say a number of things, but I'm curious what this director would say. I read an article on Slate.com yesterday that I actually found a pretty ridiculous, kind of trivial article, although it did make me wonder. Its point was kind of rating through a number of versions of the movie the what the author called the creepiness factor of the character of Rochester, which is not, despite his many drawbacks, that's certainly not how I've ever thought of him. But I guess I'm curious to hear from the director. Obviously, I haven't seen the film, and I'm dying to at this point, but kind of curious what his take might be on this notion of the creepiness factor of Rochester and kind of how he approached that, that particular perspective on him, if he found that to be the case himself, and, how he wanted in this film to portray Rochester.
Susan, we'll do that. Yeah. But let me ask you, did you find Rochester creepy?
As I said, he has considerable drawbacks, but I can't, and I guess I don't think anyone should, divorce the novel and the narrative from its original context, and I really don't see him, and I never have seen him as creepy.
Let us go to it, Susan. I thank you for your call. We should say, for those who haven't read Jane Eyre, here is Rochester, and he's heir to Thornfield Hall and apparently a fortune along with it. He has a bit of bad luck early in his career, as portrayed here, where he's pushed to marry a woman from Jamaica who becomes his wife, then goes mad. She's living in the attic of Thornfield Hall, and that is the burden he carries. I mean, she's mad and violent and extremely difficult. Now, there have been many interpretations of her as well, but there he is, sort of jaundiced and cynical when this very particular Jane Eyre comes into his world, and he's in that gothic setting of the big, old, gloomy hall, Cary Fukunaga. What about the creepiness factor?
Well, I think, Susan, I haven't read that article, but maybe what it was talking about was the fact that Rochester's near 38, 39 years old, and Jane's just 18. Mm-hmm. I think by today's standards, when you see couples that are dating like that, some might call the guy creepy.
It's not Larry King, but it's getting up there.
It's getting up there. I mean, she's barely legal, obviously.
Yeah.
And that plus, you know, he's the boss. He's the man that runs the manor.
Yeah.
And she's his employee and all by herself and completely vulnerable. And there's definitely a power dynamic there.
Mm-hmm.
So I haven't read the article, but just offhand, I could say there are people that would interpret that, you know, in the short version description of that as creepy on top of that, hiding his wife in the attic.
And yet he reaches through that, as Charlotte Bronte tells it, and as you show it, though the tension is great because you never know until so deep in the film whether he's sincere or playing her, as she couldn't know if you imagine this playing out in the 19th century. But it shows him reaching out through all that background and that pain and the age difference to establish a very real relationship with a young woman who will not have it any other way, despite her vulnerability and relative weakness.
Yeah. I mean, you imagine Jane has probably never even kissed anyone before she kisses him. She has no experience with men. I think what she represents to him, though, is there's a sense of purity to her, someone that hasn't yet been blighted in the way that he has, and yet is an equal in intelligence and wit and even in humor. So I think that that gets him off guard and it allows him to share a bit of his life with her. I don't think he's ever done that with anyone before and allows him to create a bond.
Here's
Mia Wasserman. What I mean by show the life is reveal elements of his personality that he wouldn't normally reveal to other people.
Mm. Here's Mia Wasikowska as Jane arriving. She's arrived at the great estate, Thornfield, and meets the housekeeper, Mrs. Fairfax, played by Judy Dench.
This Mr. Rochester? Why, the owner of Thornfield? Mr. Edward Fairfax Rochester.
I thought Thornfield Hall belonged to you.
Oh, bless you, child. What an idea. Me? I'm only the housekeeper.
She's barely been out in the world, but she gets out into the realm of heart and soul and will and determination very quickly in Cary Fukunaga's Jane Eyre. Let's go to Dean, calling from Hartford, Connecticut. Hi, Dean, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for taking my call.
Mm-hmm.
I wanted to comment on, I think Jane Eyre is still so popular very simply because it's the story of all of us, that all of us share, is yearning for love and someone to love us. And Jane certainly has that in her life. And I think that touches us even now, 100-some years later after it was written. And I also wanted to comment, the book is often thought of, I think, as a female book, a girl's book, a woman's book. And I know in my own experience, many, many men who are touched by this story and maybe go into it apprehensively and then read it and find out what a delightful, just heartbreaking, heart-loving book it is. And I just wanted to comment and say, I think that's why Jane Eyre endures to today.
I appreciate that, Dean. Thanks for that call. Cary, what about it as a women's story, a man's story?
Yeah, that's definitely universal, the idea of seeking out love and companionship, and especially when you've been sort of deprived of family, the family you try to create. At least for me, you know, the line between Sin Nombre and Jane Eyre is that theme. In Sin Nombre, you had two characters, a girl from Honduras and this boy in a street gang, neither of whom have had a real family. And I think together they see the potential of one, or at least a future, and that's what bonds them. In the same way, I think Jane Eyre, of all the hardship she's gone through, the one thing she really wants, she doesn't want money, she just wants to be respected and to be loved and to have a family. It's something she even says briefly with St. John Rivers, you know, and I don't want to spoil the ending, but, you know, mm-hmm. One of the things she makes very clear to him is that she's never had a family.
Of any kind as
yeah.
A young girl, orphaned and with the terrible, oh my gosh, what an aunt she has raising her. I mean, but I wonder what it was like to put on the 19th century kind of corset around this. In Sin Nombre, you've got, as you say, these travelers coming up through a Mexico that's so harsh, filled with gangs, anything can happen and does. Violence, just, you know, really gross violence right there at any moment. Now, you've got this terrible sense of threat in 19th century Yorkshire, but this is not gangland Mexico.
Yeah, there was no point in Jane Eyre where I was thinking about giving Rochester face tattoos or anything. But I think danger and tension, you don't need outright violence to have it. There's also psychological violence. And I think Jane has experienced that and continues to experience that throughout the story, even through Rochester's mercurial treatment of her.
Let's go to Jane in Middlesex, Vermont. Anne. Jane's on my mind. Anne, thanks for calling. Anne, you're on the air.
Hi. I just wanted to mention that what very little I heard of the soundtrack was very interesting to me, in the sense that it sounds very much like the music of that era, from the classical into the romantic era, the Schubert and Beethoven's time. I don't know if that was conscious on the point of the composer, but I found that I didn't hear very much, but I thought it was very appropriate for backdrop for the Jane Eyre story. But also it reminded me very much of the music that was being written at the time.
And we'll play a little bit more of that for you in just a minute here. The score for Cary Fukunaga's Jane Eyre by Dario Marianella. What can you tell us about it, Cary, and how it came to be?
Yeah, Dario Marianelli, very talented composer. He has worked with Joe Wright a lot and did the score to Pride and Prejudice. And I think one of our initial conversations were neither one of us wanted to do the score to Pride and Prejudice for this film.
Because it was too much of a kind of minuet, or?
It's, you know, it's Regency. It's his version of that. It's a much more sentimental story in many ways, and his approach to the music was more of a sort of a sweeping orchestral. And I wanted this score to be raw and jagged and youthful in its sort of sometimes repetition as well. Sort of these sort of waves of sort of movements coming back again. And that was another way to express sort of Jane's passion and youthfulness. We talked a lot about instrumentation in terms of piano and the style of piano playing. We kept it very much of the era. Was it Anne was mentioning? Was that her name?
Yes, Anne.
Even down to like Blanche Ingram, when she plays a song, we had to figure out, Dario had a very strong idea of how Blanche, the kind of piano music she would play, or at least the rhythm she would play it in.
The other aristocrat who Jane fears Rochester is setting up to marry.
Exactly. So we kept it of, you know, the 1830s, 1840s era. So we were definitely conscious of that.
And do you get to make the call on the composer, or is that a joint decision with the producer? How's that work?
It's like casting all the heads of department. And a lot of names are thrown around, and availability is always comes into question. It's, it just comes down to those meetings, too, the one-on-one meetings. And if you feel like the composer has, you know, your same vision. It's definitely something that I ultimately get the final say on. But filmmaking is a collaborative process, and so there's a lot of people involved in figuring out how to make the best choice.
Tom Ashbrook, this is On Point. We're talking today with director Cary Fukunaga. Behind us there, The score from his first big feature film, his debut feature film, Sin Nombre, No Name, The Nameless, score there by Marcello Zarvos, came out to great acclaim at Sundance and beyond, award-winning. Now he's into Charlotte Bronte and Jane Eyre territory, his new film Jane Eyre, just beginning to open across the country. Carrie joins us from New York, and Jennifer's with us right now from Marlborough, New Hampshire. Hi, Jennifer. You're on the air with Carrie Fukunaga.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I was moved to call because I recently saw the movie Sin Nombre, and I found it the most amazing movie I've seen in years and years, and it was so thought-provoking and stayed with me for so many days afterwards. It was incredible, and I'm also a big fan of Jane Eyre, and I can't wait to see the movie, so thank you.
Does it make sense, Jennifer? Can you put the two together? Can you see the director of Sin Nombre going to, you know, the great hall on the moor in the 19th century in Yorkshire?
You know, yeah, there is something probably universal about both of those stories that is so touching. It just grabs people somewhere where they are. So both of those stories, even though they're so different, I could see how a person would want to tackle them both.
Jennifer, thanks for calling. Compliments to you there from Jennifer. Carrie, what kind of career are you trying to put together where you go from Sin Nombre to Jane Eyre? You're young, so it has to be, I'm sure you have to like the Bronte story, but there's got to be something strategic, too, about how you look at your next step.
I suppose I should be more strategic. I haven't really given it that much thought. I was writing another project, another screenplay, when I was traveling with Sin Nombre. So when Jane Eyre popped up, it wasn't necessarily like I'd been planning to go from doing sort of what could be described as a gritty social drama into period filmmaking. It just sort of happened, and I'm just sort of the ilk, I guess, that when there's an opportunity, I take it.
But do you have models among directors who have, I don't know, worked in a great variety of sort of colors and tones and times in their films? I think Ang Lee is one of your admired directors. Are you trying to create that kind of broad palette or hoping to?
Yeah, certainly Ang Lee and Alfonso Cuarón and you know, directors who've had sort of diverse resumes in terms of directing. Also, I've just always wanted to travel and live in other places. And I literally, the idea of spending a year and a half to 2 years in England seemed really exciting to me at that moment. After especially being in Central America for so long, just a change of scenery, a change of experience. Because when you make a film, you basically start to specialize on that subject. Mm-hmm. And you spend a lot of time in it. And it becomes, you know, a major part of your development, I guess, as a human being. And for me, I'd like just to keep that moving and be in different places. I think I've been told recently by the people that are supposed to be, you know, helping guide my career and strategize that making a movie in America might be a good idea at some point.
Someday, somewhere, from Sin Nombre to Jane Eyre. Here's another, a little bit more, where Jane speaks to Rochester, Mia Wasikowska and Michael Fassbender. And you can see, well, just what unfolds here.
Your gaze is very direct, Miss Anne. Do you think me handsome?
No, sir.
You're afraid of me.
I'm not afraid.
You're not handsome and I'm not afraid. Let's go to Julie in Cambridge, Massachusetts. Hi, Julie. Thank you for calling. You're on the air with Carrie Fukunaga.
Oh, what an honor. Thank you so much, long-time listener. The question I have is I have a son who's about to, who's an aspiring filmmaker, and I wanted to know how NYU Film influenced your career.
Gary, please, yeah. Thanks, Julie.
Hi, Julie. I wanted to live in New York. I'd been living in California most of my life. And so the only school I applied to was New York University because I'd heard it was the best school, but also the idea of living in Manhattan at that time was exciting to me. And, you know, it's a big consideration, I think, going to film school, especially graduate school, because of the debt you incur. I don't know about how your son will deal with financial aid, but there's a reality that you can walk out of that experience with a $200,000 debt.
Mm.
You know, it's like owning a house and you're not even, you know, out of your 20s yet.
You're scaring Julie to death right now. Mom.
I mean, I think NYU is close to $40,000 a year, and that's just tuition, not even thinking about living costs. So on one level for me, you know, the decision to go there was because it was a gamble, it was a crapshoot, because I knew I'd have 3 years just to focus on making film and experimenting and doing as much as I could. And I would and I was determined to make as much of that experience as possible. And then on the other side, you have this incredibly incomprehensible debt you're going to walk out with.
You made the most of it, financially. Didn't Sin Nombre grow right out of that time?
I think technically Sin Nombre is my thesis film. I haven't actually officially graduated from NYU. But, you know, it's what the great thing about film school is it provides you with a community. And I have a lot of great friends, I would consider best friends now, that I made out of NYU and who are doing really great out there in the world. One of my classmates, Mark Heyman, wrote Black Swan, for example. Wow. Mm. And, you know, we're incredibly close and honest with each other and help each other out. And that's the best thing you can have, I think, as a young filmmaker in a very difficult, to maneuver industry, is to have people you can trust and whose creative, I think, perspective is something you can trust and people you look up to as well. So I think for me, I feel incredibly lucky even to have fallen in with the class that I had at NYU. And I think those people will probably remain my friends the rest of my life.
Your career's off to an amazing start. Does that happen just simply on the strength of your work? Do you have to find, I don't know, is there a system anymore? Do you have to find a kind of a sponsor, you know, or some fairy godfather, mother, somebody, some power in Hollywood who says, wow, this guy's great, I want to back him? Or does the work pull you forward? How does it feel, Gary?
I think no one's path is going to be the same. But it's a mixture of both those things you said. I think you need people to recognize you and help you. I certainly have had people at every step of the way, you know, help me out or maybe see something in what I'm doing and see some merit in giving me a grant or a fellowship or letting me get into the Sundance, you know, filmmaking labs or accepting my first short films at festivals. Those are all those people play a huge part, I think, in developing your career. You definitely don't do it on your own. Or in isolation. And I'm not really sure what's happening now. Obviously, the scape is always changing, especially mm-hmm. with the economy and what kind of films are being financed. And I think I got really lucky to make Sin Nombre the year that I made it in, which just before the first writer strike, I think, around mm-hmm. 2007. And I think it's become even more difficult since then to make films, especially of that sort. So because of that changing landscape, you don't really know what strategy is best. When I made the short film Victoria Parachino that led to Sin Nombre, that mm-hmm. I wasn't making that short film as a sort of calling card. I definitely wasn't making that short film to start my career. I was making that film because I wanted to make that film because I'd read the story about this truck in Victoria, Texas, where these immigrants died in 2003, and I wanted to tell that story at that particular time. And that was my second year project. It wasn't my thesis project. I thought mm-hmm. I'd make a sort of flashier film at some point. But because of that film, I learned about the trains. Because I learned about the trains, I wrote the script, and then Sin Nombre happened. So, I'm not sure if you could really plan or strategize. You just got to do the work, and hopefully, you're doing the work for the right reason, and hopefully, people see it.
Julie, and thanks for your call. Yeah, let's hope you're a budding movie maven. Julie follows that path, but yeah. Find it and stay on it. Carrie Fukunaga with us. The Jane Eyre is the new film. Jane is calling from Lexington, Kentucky. Hi, Jane. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I was wondering if either the director or the lead characters of Jane Eyre were familiar with the story and the film The Wide Sargasso Sea. And right now, the author of the book eludes me, but it's the backstory of Bertha Rochester.
Yeah, Bertha Rochester, who is the in Charlotte Bronte's story, this is portrayed as the sort of mad wife in the attic from a marriage in Jamaica when Rochester is young. We've had other people asking about this as well online, Jane, saying, you know, what about that angle, the narrative from the point of view of what one of our listeners describes as the tragic mulatta? But what's your question on that front, Jane?
Well, it gives a lot of understanding to Rochester's disgust with himself, not to mention, and this is kind of to the side, but Bertha's fascination with fire and her memories of the heat and the sun and the brightness of Jamaica, as opposed to being locked up in the attic in the damp cold of England.
Yeah.
It is a tragic story, but it gives a lot of insight into Rochester and how misguided he was.
Let's take it to Carrie Fukunaga. Yes, thanks. This is from the Jean Rhys, sort of alternate angle on Charlotte Bronte's story, The Wide Sargasso Sea, which takes it from the perspective of the wife in the attic. Have you paid attention to it, Carrie?
Yeah, I think we're all familiar with the genre story. I think it's probably one of the most successful spin-off novels ever written on another novel. Mm-hmm. But I think the most important thing to remember about that novel is that it's not Charlotte Bronte's.
Right. It's his.
And it's its own story, and it's a great sort of, I think, depiction and study of where Bertha Mason could have come from. In this particular case, this is definitely inspired by the Charlotte Bronte novel, Jane Eyre. And so my interpretation of Bertha will be based partially on what Charlotte described about her, but also what I was trying to decipher from her understanding of madness at that point in time, which is before psychoanalytical studies. It was pre psychology, really. Mm-hmm. So, I think we made specific choices, especially about race, not to make her mulatto, for example, but to make her to interpret Creole as being white colonialism rather than mixed blood.
In the brief moment that we see her in your film, she looks like quite the beauty. I think in the Charlotte Bronte's telling, that is not the case. How'd you make that decision?
Yeah, I think Charlotte describes her features as being swollen and purple and her hair matted. I think it was sort of an anachronistic depiction of a psychotic state at that time period. And I wanted to go for something that felt a bit more naturalistic.
Let's go to Jean. Thank you, Jane, for calling. Let's go to Jean in Newburyport, Massachusetts. Jean, you're on the air.
Yeah, hi, Tom. Well, thank you for discussing this book. It's one of my favorite novels. And I think, like one of your callers had mentioned, it is a timeless novel that speaks to the heart of what we all, I think we all long for in a love relationship. And with that, I wanted to just share one of my favorite lines in the book, because I really think it does share that core of the love that the two of them are finding in each other. And this is Jane speaking, and she says, "What do I want with half your estate? I would much rather have all of your confidence. Will you not exclude me from your confidence if you admit me into your heart?" And that's the end of the quote. So I just wanted to share that.
It's a great line, and thank you, Jane. And you have so many... I mean, well, I guess that's wrong. Not so many, but you've got just the right sort of mini-speeches, it seemed to me, Carrie, in here to get across the moral and intellectual weight of Jane Eyre, as Charlotte Bronte portrays her. That must have been something to pick out which moment she gets the soliloquy.
Yeah. I think that what makes a novel such a wonderful piece of literature is the wealth of lines like that. I think Charlotte's sort of insight in her own emotional state, as well as others, as well as the observations of the time. There's such great, great phrases in there. I think Mia, Michael, and I all had our kind of like underlined versions of the book, and I think our entire book was pretty much underlined of our favorite sort of little bits and pieces, and we tried to put as much of it in there as possible, within the limits of of a scene. And definitely rearrange dialogue and stuff to try to find ways to include some of our favorite lines. I think it's a testament to Charlotte's writing style that even today we can just really appreciate it.
I loved just reading back in the book before talking to you today, Carrie, and after seeing your movie, reading the preface that Charlotte Bronte wrote. What a feisty, clear mind, and apparently there were some critics of the book back in its day because it was sort of riling things up, even though it was so popular. And she turns in her preface on the timorous or carping few and lectures them. In her preface, she says, "Conventionality is not morality. Self-righteousness is not religion. Narrow human doctrines that only tend to elate and magnify a few should not be substituted for the world-redeeming creed." This is Charlotte Bronte writing of Christ. "The world may hate him who dares to scrutinize and expose, but hate as it will, it is indebted to him. He uses him, even though she's she. But man, she has got the sword on fire there, Carrie. This was no
tame horse. This is why it's hard to separate Jane and Charlotte. They're very much the same.
They are indeed right there. I've got to ask you, because we're talking today Do you have family in Japan? Are you on the phone over there? They got this huge earthquake. Do you know? Is everybody okay?
Most of my family's in Tokyo and in the south. I haven't spoken to anyone yet, but it's a tragedy. Yeah.
Huge, huge quake in Japan today. Cary Fukunaga, it's been a pleasure speaking with you. It's a terrific film. Congratulations on the early reviews coming in. I know a lot of people are really going to enjoy this. And after Sin Nombre and now Jane Eyre, we look forward to your next projects. May they be many. Thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you.
Cary Fukunaga, director of the new version, the latest of Jane Eyre, opening this weekend in Los Angeles and New York, and then weekend by weekend on across the country. Listeners, you can continue the conversation and get the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org. Follow us on Twitter, find us on Facebook at On Point Radio, and when you go to Facebook, hit the like button and become a fan there. You'll get the early word on upcoming shows. On Point is produced by Julie Jupp, Sam Gail Rosen, Ping Wong, Eileen Amata, Stefano Katsonis, Hillary McQuilkin, Kate Osborne, and James Ross. With help from Matt Baskin, Asad Rahim, and Dean Russell, our senior producer is Karen Schiffman. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Thanks for joining us.